Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
What's going on, y'all? It's your host, Will, coming back for a new episode of the Hunt Stand Podcast. And specifically, this is the final episode to season 2. And before we get started, we just want to wish all of y'all a happy new year and hope that you had a very Merry Christmas and happy holidays with family and friends. On this week's episode, we are going to be getting on Tony Shunin, who is the CEO of the Boone and Crockett Club. Now, when a lot of y'all hear Boone and Crockett, BNC, or you hear Booner, all that stuff, you automatically think Score, which that's what the Boone and Crockett Club does, but they do a lot more. And so I'm not going to get into that too much. I'm going to let Tony explain that as we get him on here and talk everything Boone and Crockett Club. And again, he's the CEO. But before we get started, I want to make sure you have the Hunt Stand app downloaded. We've got the free tier, we've got Pro, and then we've got Pro Whitetail. If you want to unlock all the features of Hunt Stand, upgrade to Pro Whitetail today. And again, y'all, we just want to thank all y'all for the support over the past two seasons of the Hunt Stand podcast. It's been awesome, and we couldn't be doing this without y'all. So we just want to say thank you. But I'm going to quit talking and let's get right to it with Tony. All right. Well, Tony, welcome to the Hunt Stand Podcast.
Thanks, Will. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. I'm excited to talk Boone and Crockett Club today with you. But before we do, I like for our guests to give the listeners just kind of that, what I call the 30-foot tree stand view. I know, obviously, you're up in Montana, so you may not get up in a tree too much, but just kind of give us that, you know, 30,000-foot view of yourself and tell us about yourself.
I have been in the outdoor space for close to 30 years. I started out with a video production company called Stonewall Productions.
Okay.
We were one of the first production companies on the market with videos way back when videos were the thing. And I sold that company and I went into the nonprofit sector. I started working with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation as their VP of marketing and communications. And then I worked as the executive director of Wonders of Wildlife Museum and Aquarium in Springfield, Missouri. And now I've been with the Boone and Crockett Club for about the last 15 years.
Awesome. That's awesome. So, man, that's quite the track record. I mean, pretty cool resume that you got there. Just kind of a wide variety too. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've had a few whistle stops, but it's been a pretty exciting career, and it's I got started pretty early on, 18 years old.
Wow. So, did you go to college or to do what you're doing now, or what'd you get a degree in?
So, you know, I got a business degree from the University of Montana.
Okay.
Way back when. And I was, you know, I had a partner originally, two partners actually, that originally started that video production company. And I was, I also have a river guide business that my dad started in 1958. So I had that river guide business and then the video production business that kind of carried me through college, and then that company, the video company, took off quite well. Like I said, we were only one of four, so yeah. That was when VCRs were really hitting the home markets, and people were buying them, and they were buying every kind of tape they could find, lay their hands on, and watch. And so, you know, that was something that, you know, was a pretty good accomplishment. because we started from nothing, and you know, we did okay.
I'd say so, man. Were y'all focused primarily with you being in Montana on Western big game, or did y'all do a lot of whitetail stuff, fishing? What all did y'all kind of cover?
Well, I mean, we covered the gamut. You know, we started out with elk. You know, that we produced the first ever elk hunting tape in the Rocky Mountain West, and then stuck with Western stuff, mule deer, whitetail. But then we did start going into waterfowl hunting, mm-hmm. and actually ended up doing some projects overseas with education programming for kids. And we did a lot of filming in 1988 when all those fires were going on in Yellowstone. And wow. So, you know, we kind of ended up branching out in a lot of different directions, but we never lost our roots with the American sportsmen and women trying to provide them with good quality entertainment.
Yeah, man. And then from there, you moved from that to, was it RMEF or was it Springfield was next?
Yeah, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation was here in Missoula. And after I sold that company, I went to work for them and was their VP of marketing communications, oversaw membership, conventions, marketing, corporate sponsorships, merchandise procurement for a banquet program. It was a fairly large portfolio at Rocky Mountain Elk.
Wow. Now you're with Boone and Crockett.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been a really exciting organization. It's an old organization. We were founded in 1887 by Theodore Roosevelt and George Bird Grinnell and several other folks that were sportsmen. Mm-hmm. And the beginning is kind of interesting because Theodore Roosevelt lost his wife and his mom on the same day in 1883. And so he went out west. He had two ranches in and around Medora, North Dakota.
Okay.
And he was pretty busted up emotionally. But when he was out there, he rode around and he was looking actually to shoot a buffalo and he couldn't find one. But he rode around Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, the Dakotas, and he saw a lot of things that didn't make him happy, you know. Mm-hmm. Basically decimation of our wildlife species, pillaging of our natural resources. And so when he came back to New York City in 1887, he called a dinner that first weekend of 1887, in December of 1887, and got all these people at the table that were influential in the world of science and education and politics and industry. But the one thing that joined all of them together, the common thread there was they were all sportsmen. And their first step was to try to preserve the memory of big game.
Right.
And so they started the National Collection of Heads and Horns, which is now resides at the Wonders of Wildlife Museum and Aquarium in Springfield, Missouri. Okay. And the goal there was to try to get one of every species of big game animals on Earth that, that they could put into an exhibit so that people could always remember what they looked like after they went extinct. Well, somewhere along there, the plan changed and they said, well, rather than trying to remember these species, why don't we try to conserve them? And so, you know, their first huge push was the Yellowstone Park Preservation Act in 1892. And that expanded the park's borders. It solidified and got rid of everybody who was in the park doing things like harvesting timber, killing animals, things that they weren't supposed to do. And then when he got to be president, that's when the club and the conservation movement really kind of picked up momentum. They, they established what's now the forest system, U.S. forest system. They established the national park system, the national wild refuge system. They got management of game in the states, the established state game laws. And, these were all efforts that were driven by the members of Boone and Crockett. Mm-hmm. You know, we were the earliest conservation group out there at the time. So, and if you fast forward, you know, in like the 1930s, everybody was scratching their heads saying, well, did all this conservation work and all this land that we preserved in the public interest, public trust, is it working? And that's when we started our records program. And so the science behind that is we try to, they feel that they felt at the time that if you harvest a mature male specimen in an ecosystem, well, is that's an indicator that that ecosystem is healthy. And that's been the premise mm-hmm. of our record system ever since. You know, yeah. we still tabulate data from all over the North American continent. We probably process 4,500 entries a year.
Wow.
We maintain that database. Wildlife managers use that database. College students use that database. In fact, academics in general use that database a lot to compare one ecosystem to another to see, okay, you know, I've got a great population of white-tailed deer and the bucks are not what I think they should be. You know, what am I doing wrong? And so they'll look at another ecosystem that's kind of comparable that has, you know, larger animals and obviously healthier ones. And then they'll compare the notes with those wildlife managers and say, you know, okay, here's what I need to change in my wildlife management practices. So the records program was pretty integral as a measurement tool mm-hmm. to our organization. And even though when you say Boone and Crockett, everybody thinks of heads and horns, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's really in essence only about 10% of our budget. And most of our efforts are spent on the conservation policy side in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. In our education programs, both at our Theodore Roosevelt Memorial Ranch. And also we have endowed chairs at several land grant universities that are teaching students about not only science and biology, but policy and the cultures that they're going to work in. So, you know, that's a pretty important piece of what we do. And then, you know, Fair Chase hunting has been a cornerstone of our organization since day one.
Yep.
And so hunting ethics and education is another major emphasis for our organization. And, but, you know, when you look at like our policy efforts, you know, we are kind of looked to as a think tank group because we're not structured like other nonprofits. I mean, when Roosevelt founded the club, we have 100 regular members, and they're basically the ones that govern the club.
Okay.
And then we have about 150 professional members, and a lot of those professional members are agency heads, members of Congress, state wildlife officials, academics, and plus there's a lot of executive directors and CEOs of other nonprofit organizations, our partners that are in that group. But we do have a grassroots base called our associate membership program where folks can just join us for $35 a year and
okay.
get our magazine and things that that hunters like to get. So, you know, that we have that opportunity, but again, as I mentioned earlier, that initial 100 was people that were picked because of their influence in the outdoor space mm-hmm. and, you know, their knowledge of politics and industry and education. And that's the way we started. That's the way we are today. And we work very hard to get legislation passed in Congress that will benefit conservation,
yep.
that will provide funding for conservation, that will encourage public access, that will make sure that you know our wildlife management practices are in sync with what the states are mm-hmm. doing.
Right.
And so
right.
A lot of there's a lot of work there, but we're again we. With the brain trust that we've got, we look at a problem, we formulate a solution, and then we partner with our partner organizations to help push those things, you know, that solution through Congress mm-hmm. in the form of legislation.
Man, this is a big part. I'm going off my own little set that I have here of things I want to ask you, but this is I feel like a big part coming back to that membership thing. You know, I'm 31 years old, you know, in terms of being in the outdoor space, I'm pretty young at it, but I've been hunting my whole life. And the thing that I've noticed as I've gotten older, you know, especially I've done a lot of reading up on Theodore Roosevelt, probably the past 2 years, just different readings, books, learning about land conservation, that growing up as a kid, all I wanted to do was kill big bucks. Never thought about how we conserve them. Then as I get older, start getting into Western hunting, looking at a big game further out west. And now as I get older, and I think it's important that organizations like Boone and Crockett exist, because now I'm like, man, thinking about all these bad people out there that want to take away what we enjoy too, and what y'all do to conserve that. I mean, this is something that as I get older, becomes more and more important to me than it did 60 days ago or 90 days ago, or even just a year ago, you know? So I think what y'all do is awesome. And what I want to kind of get into next is, talk to us about, you know, you've highlighted a lot of what y'all do, but talk to us about like what the main mission of Boone and Crockett Club. What is the main mission?
Well, you know, the mission itself is fairly broad. You know, we promote the conservation and management of wildlife, especially big game species.
Right.
And also the habitat, and to preserve and encourage hunting, and to maintain the highest ethical standards of fair chase and sportsmanship in North America. That is our mission.
Right.
But there's a lot of, and it's broad, like I said, it's broad and all encompassing, but there's a lot of subsets of that. Right. So yes. The three stools of our mission are policy, research, and education. And so, you know, we do a lot of, again, research for identifying solutions to issues that face our outdoor community, our wildlife and wild places, trying to come up with things that ways to fix those. Mm-hmm. And it's. So, you know, when you talk about big game, and you talk about, mule deer or elk or sheep,
right?
You know, and they have migration corridors that that these animals travel through. So when you work on big game species, it impacts non-game species and birds as well, and right. wetlands, and because it's all habitat that big game species need to survive. And if that habitat's healthy, it's going to benefit a whole lot of other species too, as right. well as things like, you know, modern day issues like climate change, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at carbon sequestration, for example, you know, a healthy forest, one that's well-managed, a healthy grassland, one that's well-managed is going to benefit and sequester carbon and benefit climate change. It'll mm-hmm. reduce the amount of catastrophic wildfires, which actually put a ton of carbon into the atmosphere. And at the same time, while you're looking at solving that piece of the puzzle, you're also making sure that the habitat's healthy for the species that live there.
Right. You know, and it's the thing is, I've talked with some gentlemen from the National Wild Turkey Federation, and mm-hmm. kind of covering what you talked about, you know, the things that y'all do habitat wise, sure. Let's talk elk, for example. Sure, you're doing things to benefit elk, but at the same time, you're benefiting everything else that's within that habitat. And it's like what the NWTF does; they do things to obviously promote more turkey numbers. That's something that's kind of been suffering lately, and so they do things to help that. But at the same time, they're also helping out many other species as well. So it's not just benefiting one species per se, but it's everything that we enjoy, right?
Right. No, National Wild Turkey Federation, awesome folks. Yeah. You know, they work very closely with our group as well as a few other groups on these forest health issues I talked about.
Right.
And that's very near and dear to their mission. And,
yeah.
And yeah, we've worked closely with them. As a matter of fact, what a lot of folks don't realize out there that, you know, are in the field every day hunting, and is that, you know, the American sportsman today is probably better organized than we've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we formed a coalition actually right in our headquarters building here in Missoula, Montana, back in 2000, called the American Wildlife Conservation Partners. And, you know, originally, and they were groups like the National Wild Turkey Federation, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. I mean, there were 17, conservation, sportsman's based conservation groups that gathered at that first summit. And, And we built that coalition ever since for the last 20 years. And today, you know, we that coalition consists of 56 groups that represent 15 million hunters and shooters across this country. And so, you know, when we all come together, as a matter of fact, we're working on it right now. We come together on a document every time we have a general election. It's called Wildlife for the 21st Century. Mm-hmm. And these 56 groups collectively agree on what is the most important recommendations that we can give to a new administration or an administration that stays in office. What is the most important things to conservation and shooting sports, hunting, that we can give them as a guide from our community,
right?
So that we can focus their efforts. And so we come together, we produce this document. We generally get into the hands of candidates from both parties, generally in August of the election year. So that will be August of 2024. We'll have a document ready to go. And those recommendations cover everything from, you know, habitat health, wildlife health, public access, the whole gamut of what's important to our hunting and shooting sports community. And, more shooting ranges, more opportunities for our kids to get out there and be at those shooting ranges. These are all recommendations, and there's generally about 10 to 12 of them. We try to keep it as simple as possible.
Right.
So, because he's got a whole lot of other things to worry about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whoever gets into those offices, you know, they've got education stuff to worry about and economy stuff to worry about and stock market stuff. So, you know, from our community, even though we kind of represent the folks who are doing what we can to conserve our natural resources, which is one of the greatest national treasures that we have in this nation, our voice is we still have a voice, and it's important that I think our hunters and anglers out there know that, and also our shooting sports folks, that, you know, we've got organization at the top levels of all these different groups that are pushing for a common thing that will benefit our community.
Absolutely. I mean, y'all are essentially the megaphone for men and women and kids like myself.
Right.
That's exactly what y'all do.
And it's worked. I mean, I'll be honest, you know, we've come together on a number of issues that have popped up, you know, in the last 2 to 4 years that, we literally changed the direction of that dialogue because of who we were, what we knew, and how many people we represented. And again, when I say we, I'm talking this AWCP coalition that is, you know, millions of hunters and shooters.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's not just a small section of us. It's all of us. So that's
right.
Have to say thank you for helping protect that, you know, essentially so we can enjoy and go and get some elk like that are behind me. So what I want to go into next, you know, since 1887, maybe we can talk more of a modern scope per se, rather than maybe early 19s or mid 1900s. But what would you say are some of the key achievements that Boone and Crockett Club has done since that time, maybe more modern, just for the sake of this conversation?
Well, you know, we have been involved with a number of acts that have been passed, recently, you know, and again, when I say we, you know, Boone and Crockett, this unit that we have in our community with all these other groups is really what moves the needle for conservation.
Right.
If you didn't have these other groups coming together with a singular voice, you know, we wouldn't be as successful. But we had a huge voice in the Great American Outdoors Act that passed in 2020 that pumped a lot of money into conservation, authorized and funded the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And, you know, we had the Inflation Reduction Act, which put more money out there and into our federal agencies like USDA and Department of Interior, you know, to try to get money out there on the ground doing good and worthwhile conservation work. The Bipartisan Infrastructure Act was another act that was passed with a lot of community effort that, again, generated more funding. And so, you know, those are, you know, Those are three that that we have done just in the last 3 or 4 years. And the American Enhancement Act's another one. We've got, we had a bill that passed that provided states with money to build more shooting ranges. So, you know, these are all things that help perpetuate our hunting heritage, our outdoor heritage. And what hunters do for land and wildlife, you know, not only does it benefit, you know, species besides big game, but also benefits people. You know, we, you know, we have, you know, the land that we help preserve and the habitat that we, and the wildlife that we help protect is enjoyed by the general public. Absolutely. So it goes way beyond hunting and yes. way beyond shooting. It, you know, we're literally trying to keep that pathway open going into the future for the next generation.
You've got to, and I think that's an important thing, a big thing. You know, like I told you, you know, just within the past few years of my life, just reading up and understanding more of how we have these lands and everything, it's huge. And I think that's important for essentially fostering that growth of, you know, not even just the hunting community. Like there's other types of sports and recreation that enjoy all the different lands and resources that are available. And that's where I kind of want to go into, you spoke on it earlier, is the fair chase. Talk to us about that and what exactly that is.
So fair chase is all about wild and free ranging animals, whether they're migratory animals. But you know, these animals have got to be, you know, they have to be able to move around, you know, from ecosystem to ecosystem.
Right.
And fair chase is a code that the club adopted and several other organizations have now adopted it too. But to try to talk to the hunting community about ethics, you know, yeah. what, you know, we're not going to write a bunch of rules and say, you know, you're not fair chase hunter unless you follow all these rules. That's not what you want to do, is have people think about before they take that shot, pull that trigger. Are they really doing the right thing? You know, is that animal too far away?
Right.
Is that animal, you know, does that animal have the capability of escaping? You know, just stop and think, because when you get down to the bottom line, you know, are the percentage of hunters is dwindling as a part of the whole population.
Yeah.
And it's incumbent upon us to make sure that there's a percentage of that population, and today it's 77%, that support hunting. They may not hunt, but they support hunting. Mm-hmm. And in order to maintain our hunting heritage, we've got to make sure that we keep our public perception, you know, front and center, that yes, we are ethical hunters, and fair chase is a huge component of that. So my advice, my encouragement to folks that are listening to your podcast, Will, is to, you know, when you're out in the field, think about these things. Say, okay, is this something that I'm going to put on Facebook? You know,
yeah.
Or, you know, is this something that I think, you know, maybe I don't want to take this shot. Maybe the wind's blowing too hard. Maybe I have a little bit of I'm just not sure about it. You know, think about things like that, because you're representing, even on a singular level, everybody who's out there is representing the public perception of what hunters are.
Absolutely.
So that ethical action is pretty important.
That's a big thing, because I feel like there is a small section of the hunting group that they choose to make bad decisions. And unfortunately, I feel like those are the things that capture most of the spotlight, and that's what gives hunters a bad name for people that are unfamiliar with it, wouldn't you say?
Right. No, I mean, poaching is a good example.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, hunting's legal, poaching's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that simple. When people choose to poach, then, you know, they're breaking the law. They're stealing from the public trust. You know, that is not good for our image. And, you know, I think we're on a major anti-poaching campaign right now called Poach and Pay. And the thrust of that campaign is basically to identify you know, what states have adequate restitution for taking from the public trust and fines? And then also, where does that money go? You know, I mean, in some states, it might go to the general fund. In some states, it goes where it should go, which is back to the Wildlife Management Agency to manage wildlife. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're trying to, first of all, do research on what states are doing now. And then we're going to develop legislative language that they can then introduce into their state houses to ensure that those restitution and fine levels are where they're supposed to be and that money's going where it's supposed to go. And then the third component of that is the judicial system, because often poaching is looked at as a victimless crime, you know, and but it's not, you know, it's when you look at what the taking of an animal from the public trust could potentially cost the public in, you know, at large, it's a significant number. And so it's not a victimless crime. So I think educating our judges and folks in the judicial system about that is important as well. And, you know, we've been working on that now for 3 or 4 years and we're making progress. And a lot of states have turned around and said, hey, you know, we got to change some things that we're doing here. Yeah. So we can get, you know, more law enforcement on the ground, more, you know, more conviction, you know, raise our conviction rates. Mm-hmm. And again, that's all the kind of, it all goes back to protecting that image of hunters. I mean, if we portray ourselves as, you know, we're serious about this, we're good hunters, we're responsible hunters, but we're also going to police our own ranks for those of us who choose to go down the wrong path.
Right.
I think that sends a really good message to the American public at large.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a big thing, because I've seen it too many times that, you know, you spoke on it a little bit ago, you know, talking about whether or not you should take an ethical shot with, depending on what the wind's doing, if you're taking a long range shot, you know, there's all these different things and, situational things that happen that I think a lot of times, again, just kind of coming back to it, it's people make decisions that they probably shouldn't have made that shot, or they shouldn't have shot that animal with a certain weapon or whatnot, that, sometimes it just sheds that negative light. And I'm glad to hear that y'all are doing things to help, you know, especially when it comes to poaching, govern those things, because nothing makes me more mad. I mean, we, excuse me, my wife's family's got a piece of property that's borders a highway, and nothing makes me more mad. Luckily, we haven't run across this issue, but I've had friends that have similar situations. Then somebody pulls up side of the road, they shine a light up in that field, and they illegally take an animal in the middle of the night off their field. And sometimes that's a really big buck that somebody's been trying to get. And so I'm glad that y'all are doing things to essentially help mitigate a problem like that.
Well, you touched on something there, Will. Now, I'm not going to run down a rabbit hole on this, but it's kind of interesting with some of the research that we've done, because you know, right now we're working on a piece of research that is actually interviewing people who have been convicted of poaching to try to identify what the motivation was for them. I mean, if it was sustenance, you know, I'm out of a job and eat meat in the freezer, that's one thing,
right?
But if they're going out there, you know, and they see a big buck and they shoot that big animal and they take the head, throw it in the trunk, and away they go because they're going to sell the antlers, that's a whole crime of different nature. And you've got both out there, right? So, and I think, you know, again, going back to the to what we're trying to do is that, you know, it's going to establish a baseline for this, for the folks that are just, you know, doing it for sustenance. But then, you know, if you're poaching trophies and selling the antlers, that's going to be a significantly higher criminal offense. And so, you know, we're taking a lot into consideration when we're looking at this whole issue of poaching, because people, you know, people are motivated differently for different ways that they poach. And so, you know, we're trying to get a handle on that. And as well as part of our as part of the data that we'll share with the state houses when the time comes, and with the governor's offices. And and so it's but there is a distinct difference between the trophy piece and the sustenance piece.
Yeah, those are I don't know if polar opposites is the right word, but yeah, I mean, those are two completely different situations. And so, yeah, there's, you know, it almost kind of makes me want to go down the same rabbit hole with a lot of CWD regulations that are going out now, right? There's a lot of people that are very aware of different state CWD regulations, and then there's some people that they had no idea, you know, that people are getting in big time trouble with some of these different things. That, yeah, just it all comes down to different cases, I guess you could say, different situations, just what it is.
So, you know, and on CWD, that is, you know, wildlife health is one of our priorities with Boone and Crockett, as along with other organizations as well. But, you know, that's a concerning one because it's continuing to spread.
Yes.
And up until recently, the states were basically funding CWD management on their own. And we passed this Chronic Wasting Disease Research and Management Act last year. It was funded to the tune of about $15 million to try to go back to the states and help them out. So the states that are that have CWD present, there's about 30 of them, 35. And they're spending an average of about $2 million per state to manage CWD. So what our goal is to generate $70 million to match the $2 million that they're already putting in. And we're making some progress there. You know, we're going to go from $15 million this year to, we have a House bill that has $18 million in it and a Senate bill that has $15 million in it. So we're basically going to double where we're at this year, and we'll continue to push to double that money next year. And I think that, you know, this is a disease that is there's no cure for it. There's no live test for it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a serious situation. It's a prion that can live in the dirt or grass for 5 years.
Yeah.
And it takes tremendous amount of heat to kill a thing. And so, and what's interesting is you can have one animal transmit that prion to another animal, and it may not manifest itself for years. It could live in that animal for, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years before it all of a sudden decided it's going to manifest itself and take that animal's life.
Right.
I just saw in the news this morning that they found the first confirmed CWD animal that died in Yellowstone National Park.
Really?
Near Yellowstone Lake. So, you know, we have got to stay ahead of this problem. And the only way to do it is get more money get to our state agencies to enable them to manage it and manage the spread. So, you know, there is work going on there that you know, we're moving along. It's not quite as quick as we would like to see it move along, but it's important work. And we're also pumping money into the research on CWD for a live test. That's going to be a big number, a really big number, yeah, you know, because
I imagine so.
You know, the CWD scare is actually causing, well, you know, I told you I'm going to go into the elk woods this weekend, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going smack dab into the hot zone, you know, for CWD in Southwest Montana. There's not been a confirmed elk that has, you know, that has been tested positive for CWD, but there's been a number of whitetail and mule deer in that area that have tested positive for CWD. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the, you know, when you test, you know, you basically have to store your animal in a cooler until you get the test back before you can really cut it up and put it in your freezer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be a lot nicer if we could just figure out a way to make CWD go away, you know, but that's going to take some resources.
Yeah. Resources. And like you said, trying to give the states more power to properly management from a financial perspective, and then, being able to educate their general public on it. Cause it's been around for a while, but it's, I feel like it's a fairly new concept to a lot of hunters that maybe haven't dealt with it yet. So I think it's important to educate people on it.
And just, you know, just for your listeners' benefit, if they're interested, they can go to the Chronic Wasting Disease Alliance website, and CWU Alliance, and it has all the information on a state by state basis about regulations and things like that that would be helpful for hunters to know, especially if they're shooting an animal in one state that's CWD positive and transport it to a state that's not
exactly
CWD positive.
Yes.
You know, and so those rules and regulations are basically consolidated in one spot that's easy access for folks to look at and know what they should and shouldn't be doing.
1000%, because you don't ever want to find yourself in a sticky situation. So other than CWD and things with poaching, what are some other partnerships, initiatives, or any kind of projects that y'all are working on that are kind of in that same realm of more in the interest of the hunter?
So I mentioned one of our priorities was forest health and habitat health. We are really working hard to reverse a ninth circuit court decision called the Cottonwood decision that was made by the Ninth Circuit Court in 2015. And at the time, President Obama's Department of Justice asked the Supreme Court to review that ruling. But what that ruling did was, if you have a project on a national forest, and you may have 150 projects on this national forest, but if you have a project that's contested in that national forest, that means it shuts down all 149 other projects. And you have to go back to the drawing board. And it's a really, we're trying to reverse that decision, because what will happen if we can do that is we'll be able to get, you know, every national forest in the ninth district to start being able to be, you know, active forest management, prescribed burns, thinning. And with that, what happens when you're able to do that, then that opens up the area for so surreal vegetation to start growing, and that's what benefits elk, deer, and so you'll provide more habitat for elk and deer, more hunting opportunity for those animals. And so while it sounds like more of a scientific forest issue, it's really, it boils right down to improving habitat for big game and being able to manage our forests in the western states like we should be, like we are supposed to. On the flip side of that, a well-managed forest, as I mentioned before, will sequester carbon, so there's an impact to climate. Well-managed forest will make sure that we'll cut way back on catastrophic wildfires, which would, destroys public property, private property. We've seen what's happened in states like Colorado, in California. And so, those well-managed forests can really bring a lot of benefit to the public. We're applying that same concept to grasslands, in healthy grasslands. Now you've got not only big game, but birds, that benefit from grasslands, healthy grasslands. And again, healthy grasslands sequester carbon and provide habitat for wildlife to live, for people to enjoy. So, I'm mentioning those two issues, Will, because there's a lot of different pieces of legislation that impact those two issues. We've got pieces of the Farm Bill that are going to be addressing that. We have standalone legislation that addresses those issues. We have companion bills. And so, when you look at how you get something done in Congress, it's great to try to do more than just one approach, because a lot of times, if you have something that dies on the floor over here, or dies in committee over here, it's still a part of something else that might make it through that committee. And so it's a multi-faceted approach. So those are two issues: rangeland health, forest health, that that are direct benefit to hunters and anybody who enjoys the great outdoors. We have a number of people that are interested in things like the Endangered Species Act. We're in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, we are the epicenter of wolves and wolf management. We've got two populations of grizzly bears, one in Yellowstone, one in the Northern Continental Divide, and they're running all over the place. And it's important that the states not only have the ability to manage these species, but take management of those species, you know, and do it responsibly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so endangered species is high on our list, not only because here's the thing. If you look at legislation like Recovering America's Wildlife Act, it's important that money is intended to keep species off the list. And there's a lot of issues that can bind up hunting opportunities if you have an endangered species and they close down the area. So, you know, getting money to states to keep species off the list is as important to as taking species that are on the list and providing an exit strategy for them to be off the list, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. It does. Yeah, speaking on that wolf and grizzly thing, I know that's a hot button thing right now out west, big time, big time. Well, man, I know we're getting short on time here. And so for some of the listeners out there that they've been listening to what we've been saying and they may be empowered to want to help out, what can those folks do or where can they go to get involved, become I think you said associate member of the Boone and Crockett Club? Right. How can they do all that?
Well, I'll tell you this, Will, I mean, we'd love to have them join the Boone and Crockett family, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if they want to join, they can go to our website. They can read about everything that we do. They can look at all of our position statements that impact hunting and shooting sports. You know, for $35 a year, they can join our group. And if what they see there doesn't really, you know, move them, then, you know, find a group out there that does. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you like elk, join Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. Yeah. If you like ducks, join Ducks Unlimited. If you like, because I'll tell you what, that participation with any of those NGOs is going to help the overall conservation movement. In addition to buying hunting licenses and paying excise, and our manufacturers that pay excise taxes on firearms and ammunition, you know, it every little bit helps. And everybody that gets engaged is going to be helpful. So we hope you want to engage with us, or maybe us and several of these other groups that may interest you. But I think just getting involved is really important. And that's a great way to do it.
Big time, because I think everything that we've talked about today has been really big and helped bring some enlightenment to what Boone and Crockett Club is, because a lot of people just think that y'all are just a scoring antlers group.
They do. And we score a lot of them.
Y'all do, but there's a lot more to it than just numbers that get put up by antlers. There's a lot of conservation work. So
you kind of got to do the conservation work to get those antlers out on the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. Get some like this that are behind me so people can get more of those. So
yep.
They may not be record book animals, but they are here in my house for me. So
everyone's got a memory well, right?
Yes.
In fact, sometimes you go out and you don't get anything, you know, but that's still a memory. You know, it's all about being out there and enjoying friends and family. And, you know, if you harvest an animal, regardless of what the size is, that's mm-hmm. just an added plus.
Yeah. That's just the icing on the cake. I've been saying that since I began my elk hunting journey back in 2019 was, hey, we're out here to enjoy what is here. If we see animals, that's great. Putting one in the freezer, that's even better. And of course, a set of awesome antlers. That's the icing on the cake. So, well, Tony, I really appreciate your time today and just helping to talk about Boone and Crockett Club, conservation work, things that y'all are doing with government agencies and everything else that y'all do. So I just appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Will. I appreciate you having me. And anything I can do to help you guys out there in the field, just give us a holler.
That sounds good. Heck, maybe we'll share some time in the elk woods sometime.
There you go. I would like that for sure.
Same here. All right, y'all, there you go. Hopefully, after hearing this podcast, you've learned a little bit more about the Boone and Crockett Club and maybe not just going to associate scoring your deer from now on, or scoring those Booner bucks and all that good stuff, which is fun.
But again, y'all, if you're interested in becoming a member of the Boone and Crockett Club, I will have that down in the podcast notes below. And again, y'all, we just want to thank y'all for tuning in to this week's episode of Hunt Stand Podcast, wrapping up season 2. And the next time you hear from me, we'll be getting into season 3. Thanks again, y'all, and we'll see you on the next one.